From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, Jeffrey Deaver, author of The Goodbye Man. He is the number one international best-selling and award-winning author of more than 40 novels, three collections of short stories, and a nonfiction law book. His books are sold in 150 countries and translated into 25 languages. A former journalist, folk singer, and attorney, he was born outside of Chicago and has a Bachelor of Journalism degree from the University of Missouri and a law degree from Fordham. He is well known for a few series, most notably perhaps those of the character Lincoln Rhyme, the quadriplegic detective made famous in The Bone Collector. His latest series features tracker and reward seeker Coulter Shaw. Here's a little information about The Goodbye Man, his new book. In the wilderness of Washington State, expert tracker Coulter Shaw has located two young men accused of a terrible hate crime. But when his pursuit takes a shocking and tragic turn, Shaw becomes desperate to discover what went so horribly wrong and if he is to blame. Shaw's search for answers leads him to a shadowy organization that bills itself as a grief support group. But is it truly a community that consoles the bereaved, or a dangerous cult with a growing body count? Undercover, Shaw joins the mysterious group, risking everything despite the fact that no reward is on offer. He soon finds that some people will stop at nothing to keep their secrets hidden and to make sure that he or those close to him say goodbye forever. When I spoke with Jeffrey Deaver, I began by asking him to talk about creating his new lead protagonist, Coulter Shaw. This is the second novel featuring Shaw, but Jeffrey Deaver also did write about him in one or two short stories. We started by talking about those. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I love short fiction, and I do those kind of as a way, you know, frankly, to promote the book and get a little excitement going. And, you know, some people may not want to commit to a whole novel, and short stories are a way to, oh, I kind of like this character, and all of my stories, like my novels, have big twists and surprises in them. So I think they'll kind of sell the longer form fiction.
Yeah. And so I wondered how it was for you to create a new hero after, you know, doing other series, and in a particular Lincoln Rhyme's long-running and successful series. How is it to design a new hero?
I always think about what I can do for my readers. You know, I'm the luckiest person on earth. I get to make up stuff for a living.
Right.
And I think the Lincoln Rhyme books, which I love and I will always continue to write, fall within a very specific genre. We call it police procedural.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with that. And it's kind of a twist because obviously he's disabled. He's kind of a modern day Sherlock Holmes. But that does limit the type of story I can tell. And I know my readers like him. Obviously, the books have done well, and that's an indication that he resonates with them. But there are a lot of other story ideas I have that don't involve a bad guy in the city of New York.
Right.
And then the Lincoln Rhyme books are limited to New York, of course, because he doesn't, I mean, he does get out some, he's been to California once or twice. He's been to North Carolina, I think, but on the whole, they're very New York centric. And so I was looking around in my mind for a new character to create, because I like series characters. I've done some standalones, but I like series characters. I always have. And I think in general, readers prefer that. So I was thinking, what can I do to have a character that's sort of the antithesis of Lincoln Rhyme, somebody who's very mobile, we could say, and is not so interested in or involved with the forensics of a crime. And I thought back to a book series I wrote some years ago called the Location Scout series about a character of mine named John Pelham, who was a location scout for movie companies. And he would go to town looking for a place to set a film and then, rather coincidentally find a crime that had occurred or was going to occur. And he played amateur private eye.
Right.
And I enjoyed the books very much. They did pretty well, but readers responded to them. I mean, it was that coincidental part. You know, Hollywood and crime certainly can mix, but it became a bit artificial. So I set that series aside. And then when I was looking for a new character to create the opposite of Lincoln Rhyme, John Pelham came to mind, and I thought, oh, well, I'll just have him go to places where a crime has occurred. That's why he goes. And so I made him a reward seeker. And so now he travels around to various places and, you know, tries to get the reward and legitimately investigates the crime.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I wasn't familiar with reward seeking as a profession. You know, I know the term vigilante and I know some of these other terms, but this is different. And it was really interesting to read about. How did you come to write about a reward seeker?
Well, Shayla, I'll have to tell you, to be honest, it really isn't a profession that people follow. No, I made it up, not completely out of whole cloth, but I thought, in fact, I've had people, the book has been out just a few days now, but I've done a few virtual events, and
right.
I've talked to some friends, and they say, that's a great job. I mean, can I send my resume to someone for it? And I said, no, probably not. I mean, if you can track down a reward and want to go investigate it, you know, good on you, but it's there's no association of professional reward seekers. But rewards are out there in possibly huge amounts. And the reason I came up with that idea, I was reading an article about a reward for a terrorist. And the reward was offered by the, I think it was the State Department, the U.S. federal government. And it was for tens of millions of dollars. And I thought, well, why wouldn't somebody pursue that as a nest egg and track down the terrorist? And then, you know, I thought, well, that might make a good adventure book, a good standalone thriller. But then I thought, I think I'll scope it down a little bit. And I looked into rewards. You just type rewards in Google and you'll find they're offered all over the place, from, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars for missing persons, escaped criminals and fugitives. Now, the authorities don't want somebody, you mentioned vigilante, that's the last thing they want.
Right, right.
They don't want you strapping on an assault rifle and going out and tracking this guy down. What they want is information. And usually the reward is $25,000 for information leading to the arrest or leading to the discovery of a missing person. But there's nothing in there that says somebody can't pursue it if they want to. And so that's what I thought would be a great idea. And so who knows, maybe I've started a trend.
No, it's funny because I recently interviewed somebody about treasure seeking. And I guess that's a thing I didn't know about either. That there are these organizations that will hide treasure in public places and then encourage people to go find it. And I was like, that's another, I don't know these things. I'm so sheltered.
I never heard about that either. Maybe I should have Coulter Shaw check out some hidden treasure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Speaking, you just mentioned his name, Coulter Shaw. You have great character names. Another name in this book is Ebbett Droon. And then his his PI that helps him is Mac McKenzie, who's a woman. Where do you come up with your character names? I was just curious.
Well, they come from two places. One is my sick and twisted imagination. And Edwin Droon, have no idea, but there it was, and it was a good name, and this isn't giving anything away, because we know right from the start this is a bad fellow, but it just sounds like a good bad name.
Yes.
And the other, so how that happens, I don't know, but to speak seriously, because I'm sure you have, given the title of your podcast, you have a potential or existing writers out there.
Yes.
One thing that's important to do is have a name that will not be confused with another name. For instance, Davies and Davidson, two different characters. We need to hold the hands of the readers. And this isn't condescending. This is simply that it's our job to make the book as enjoyable an experience as we possibly can. And if there's any confusion, it becomes less enjoyable. I saw a movie. I can't remember what it. Yes, I do. Black Hawk Down.
Oh yeah.
Great movie. Great movie. Great book and great movie. But I have to say that because there were a number of characters in the military, U.S. military, with the same haircut, they were all men, in their, probably early 20s up to the 30s. And they all looked alike to me. They looked 100% alike. And I had a lot of trouble telling them apart. Now, that was, in contrast to, say, Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, where he developed five characters who looked different, five or six characters in his platoon who looked different and, sounded different, and we could see their names. But there was nothing that the filmmaker could do about that in Black Hawk Down, because that was the reality of it. That was, a fictional account of a real event, and he was pretty close to the facts. So anyway, with the names, make them different, and don't make them unpronounceable.
Right.
As I did once, and the reason I did that is because I had to, and that's the second reason why characters are named in my book, because I donate the name to a charity. And I'll give you an example. I show dogs in things like the Westminster Dog Show, things like that. And so I contribute a character name at an auction for animal health. And so somebody will bid $5,000-$10,000 to this organization, and I have agreed to let them be in my book. They sign a waiver. I can make them the bad guy. Of course, I don't. somebody did want to be a killer once, I think, and so I did that. But you make sure they sign off on that. But so that's the other place character names go. And that was, I'm not going to mention the name. I don't want to embarrass anybody. But I'll give you the gender. She won the right, and she had a long, long, unpronounceable foreign Northern European name.
Oh wow! lots of consonants.
Five syllables. Yeah. So it was a lot of consonants. At least it wasn't Welsh. That would have been very difficult.
Well, actually, then one thing you do, which is interesting, is you have Coulter go undercover in this cult that he's investigating. And when you give him a pseudonym at the cult, you give him the same initials, which I was thinking in real life, he might not have done that. But that does help your readers, because you don't want to change his name too much, I'm thinking. Is that?
Well, that's exactly. I did that to make it a little, and actually the names were similar. Frankly, I wrote it a year and a half ago, so I don't remember what his fake name, his undercover name was.
Carter Sky,
maybe, something
yes.
like that.
Yes.
And, but I wrote a James Bond book a few years ago, Carte Blanche, because the, Ian Fleming, the original creator of James Bond, died in the 1960s, but the books have been very popular,
right.
The movies as well, of course. And so the Ian Fleming estate contacts authors and says, would you like to write a James Bond book? And since I was a big Bond fan, I said,
sure.
Oh, yes, I did. And so I studied a lot of espionage. My Bond book is a little different from the others. In it, James Bond is a hardcore spy. In the others, he's kind of an armed man about town, debonair,
right.
gentleman agent. But the fact is, in the original books and in mine, he's a gritty spy. He's a tough guy, but also uses a lot of tradecraft. And tradecraft in espionage is a fascinating topic. And one of the things I learned was that in picking a fake undercover name, spies pick something that's similar to their own.
Oh, they do.
So that yeah, because if there's a somebody will call the name out and they react to it, somebody's suspecting Bond and he's going by the name, Jim Bale, and they call out, James Bond, and he turns instinctively. He'll say, "Oh, I thought you said Jim Bale," and there's kind of an out.
Yeah.
There. So anyway, I digress. And to your listeners, I don't digress in the book as much as I do when we're talking. So rest assured, the plot moves rather quickly in the story. But that's the a name thing. So if there are any spies out there, they might want to keep that in mind.
There you go. Okay, good. Now, there are lots of threads in this. It's funny because it's a very direct through line and a great, very interesting, riveting plot. But then you have little things that are a little bit of a side plot. Like he's also, in addition to the job that he's engaged in this novel, he's also concerned about a personal matter involving his father and certain family secrets, which I'm not going to get into. But That's one. There's another little side thing where there's this other reward seeker named Crow, who's sort of his competition, and it's not friendly, although they don't, actually kill each other. But there's this other complication, and I'm wondering how it is to juggle a few different balls and how many is too many.
I am a planner, a plotter, outliner.
Right.
And you may have heard the great controversy in the writing world of plotters versus pantsers.
Right.
And the plotter plots, obviously, the pantser goes by the seat of the pants. And there's nothing more subjective than writing. Whatever works for you works.
Right.
However, I have, I've written about 43, 44 novels. My first ones were Seat of the Pants, and there was nothing wrong with them. They were nominated for awards, maybe won an award or two, but there were a lot of work to write because I didn't plan out what I was going to say ahead of time. For the last 37 or 38 novels, I have done extensive outlines. And I mean, extensive. The Goodbye Man outline was about 140 pages long. Now, in fairness, it's a very wide margin because after the outline's done, I write notes and research details on the side. So let's say it's 70 pages,
okay,
if it were full-size margins. But over the course of months, many months, I formed that outline. And that's when those subplots go in. So I can keep track of them. I give each one a code because, for instance, his father's a crime involving his father that occurred before The Never Game, the first book in the series.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a theme running through The Never Game, running through The Goodbye Man as well. I put a code on that in the outline so I can see when I arc that story. In other words, when I create conflict and then resolve that conflict, and the other subplots have their own codes as well, and their own stories and their own surprises. There has to be a twist at the end of each subplot. So my main plot in The Goodbye Man is Shaw solving this cult issue and trying to rescue somebody. So what's going on with this cult? That's the main plot, the big surprise there at the end. And then the other plots have surprises as well. And choreographing all of those can be very tricky, but if you have an outline and look at it on a big board or on the computer screen or pages, it's just much easier to do. You need a schematic of some kind. How many is too many? That's a very good question, and I wrestle with that all the time. I try to be, let me put it this way. It's not that I'm showing off. I always have in mind what I think is best for the reader. I know they like surprises. I know they like twists and the unexpected, but if you throw in too many, I think it dilutes the effect of them. So I found that a core plot, that's the core crime, and then two subplots running throughout the book is probably best. And those subplots can be a personal plot like Coulter Shaw and his family. They can be a geopolitical. In a book of mine, Lincoln Rhyme book, The Burning Wire, there was a subplot about green energy. And of course, it was grounded in the situation of some environmentalists. So it had a face on it. It had people involved in that. But the plot really was about the benefits and then also the disadvantages of green energy. And that was a subplot separate from the main plot. So I think main plot plus two is probably beneficial, but you need at least that. You could have another one if you want, but readers are really smart and they want the twist, and they're probably going to figure out one twist or another. And then I try to put in my main plot, my core plot, at least two or three reversals of that. So that looks like the book is done. Coulter Shaw may have figured out this cult. Oh, it's all done. Great. Well, we still have 40 pages left. What's going on? And then what we think is finished is not really, because of clues I set up earlier in the book, allow us to realize, oh no, Coulter Shaw has got something else going on here.
Okay. Great. And I also like, and I think it's true that your readers are very clever and they're observant. I like how you kind of, every once in a while, you'll put a little something in that's almost like a little wink at the reader. This is one quote. Coulter is a rock climber, among other things. And he says, he would prefer death to a cracked back or neck and being forced to live out his life the opposite of itinerant, chair bound. And I was like, oh, wow. That's like this total reference to Lincoln Rhyme. I loved that.
Yep. Yeah. And in fact, I suspect they will meet at some point in the future. Deaver world is fairly circumscribed.
That would be fun.
I don't let real history and real people intrude very much, but Coulter Shaw could very easily hang out with Lincoln Rhyme, I think.
Yeah. Well, then another little thing I appreciated, although not when I first started the novel, I didn't understand the implication, and perhaps it's just coincidental, but your epigram at the beginning of the book from the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian funerary text, what a journey I have made, it starts. And then in the cult, the sort of officers are called journeymen, the men and women. And I was thinking, oh, what a journey I have made. And where did you come up with your epigram? And do you go searching for those, or do you kind of mark them down when you see them in your life?
Well, I usually when I research a book, I do a lot of research. And when I'm researching, I have in mind an epigram. I need an epigram. I think I've written some that don't have them, but I kind of prefer it. It's a little kind of a convention in fiction, and they can set the tone for the book. And that one occurred to me when I was researching Immortality, which is an issue. I'm hesitating now because I don't want to give too much away, but that's a subject that comes up in the story. And I thought, oh, well, this will be perfect. And of all, you mentioned coincidence, of all odd coincidences, I had already named the higher level cult members journeymen. And then when I saw that funerary text, I said, okay, that's it. I'm picking that as the epigram, and there's also an Egyptian theme throughout the throughout the cult. So that came together well.
Yes.
You know, I have to say, I was listening to a book. I listened to a lot of books, and I won't mention it because the author had like three epigrams at the beginning of the book. Then each section, I think there were three or four sections, each one had an epigram there. And I thought, they were all kind of different, and I'm not quite sure how this relates. So again, I always think what's best for the reader, maybe just a short little thing at the beginning and let it go at that, then start telling your story.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I know from interviews I've read, and also you've mentioned today, although I don't know if you mentioned the number, but I know that you research for 8 months typically. So that's a long time. And I'm just wondering, once you've done all that research and you have this extensive outline that you've mentioned to us, how long does it actually take you then to write the book?
About 2 months.
2 months.
The outline is such a benefit, and I would recommend to your listeners out there who are aspiring authors to remember what Joyce Carol Oates, the wonderful author, said, that she never writes the first sentence until she knows what the last sentence is.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean it has to match exactly, but she knows the ending before she starts. And that is so important. I know the endings because I have the multiple endings before I sit down and write. And when I have the outline, I can write the book in any order. I may look at what where I stopped last night. Let's say I'm on page 200, and I look at my outline. Well, the next thing I should write is a murder scene, and you know, I may just not feel like writing a murder scene. Actually, action scenes are very difficult. Very difficult to write because it's hard to tell them in a fresh way. Just like romance, you know, the intimate scenes. It's hard to tell them in a way that hasn't been told 1,000 times before. And so I might not feel like writing that. Maybe I need to have more energy or more be in a different mood. But with the outline, I don't need to write that. I know where the story's going. I can jump ahead 15 scenes and write that. I can write the beginning of the book at the end and the end at the beginning. That's why an outline is so so valuable.
Yeah. John Irving does that too, I read, that he always knows the last sentence and the first sentence.
Yeah, well, and you can see how his books are constructed, how well they're built. These, you know, I consider a book like a symphony, and you need to pace it. The thrillers, at least, what I write, commercial thrillers, they're about structure as well as they are about fine prose, and you can't have two exciting scenes together. You need to kind of up the ante, move to a crescendo at the end, but alternating a slow movement, a fast movement, and then a little nice little coda at the end, something kind of soft, or something, you know, introspective. And yeah, that's what an outline helps me do.
Yeah. Okay, great. I wonder if you've read any books lately, just one or two titles that you would recommend to listeners.
Oh, yeah. I wrote a, the name is going to sound a little strange. I wrote an introduction to a wonderful Peter Lovesey mystery called Wobble to Death.
Okay.
Now, Peter Lovesey writes what would be considered Golden Age mysteries. He writes a modern series too, but he writes murder mysteries, a detective, British detective series. And Wobble to Death is set in the 1800s. And a wobble, it's a real thing, it turns out, is a marathon walking, racing, week-long competition that at the time was sort of like NASCAR. It was that popular. And it's not like a marathon nowadays that people tune into at the very end, or they might watch their friends run. People would come sit in the stands, not for days, but they'd go home and they come back again and watch the grueling toll it took on the bodies and the psyches of these people. And there were, by today's standards, hundreds of thousands of pounds and dollars involved in the betting. I mean, some bets were over $1 million on who would finish first. And there were professional wobblers. Anyway, it is a delightful book featuring Sergeant Cribb and Thackeray, his assistant, kind of a Holmes and Watson thing, although they have a very distinctive voice. So I read that, which I absolutely loved. And then I read Don Winslow's The Gentleman's Hour. And I love Winslow. He writes the surfing books and then the cartel books as well. So I've read those. I do a lot of research too. And then I was reading one of my favorite books, Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Oh, wow.
But that was for a recipe. That was not for entertainment.
That was for a recipe?
Yeah. I was doing some, well, I've been ensconced now with the coronavirus thing.
Sure.
And so I've cooked all my life. I do it as a hobby. And so I've done a couple of videos that I would encourage your listeners to go to my website or in my Instagram or Facebook account and check out. And
okay.
So anyway, great. But I just love, I have a whole collection of cookbooks and they're kind of fun to look through for relaxation purposes.
Wonderful. I just want to ask one more question. I like to finish up with a question offering advice for listeners who are writers. And in your case, I thought I would ask for advice for creating a credible enough, but also incredible hero, walking that line. Do you have any advice?
I heard something, it was a program on NPR. And I think the person being interviewed was a neurobiologist. And he was saying that the part of our brain that responds to real human beings is the same part that responds to fictional characters. That's why it is vital to create really fleshed out human beings in the books. And so, because that way, even if the plot falters a little bit, readers are going to care about them. This is going to be like watching their loved ones or their friends or their arch enemy in real life, in the office, or that bully you remember from childhood. You're going to say, okay, I respond to them. I'm emotionally engaged with this person. And so I would say, in answer to your question, create a good guy or a good girl. They have to be a hero that we like, but give them an edgy side to them. Lincoln Rhyme is a perfect example. He is a hero who will stop at nothing to catch the bad guys, but he's also irritable. He has no patience for bureaucracy, for laziness, for duplicity. And he loses his temper sometimes. And I imagine that a reader who is in love with Lincoln Rhyme, as I hope they will be, because he is the good guy, and has a bit of a sense of humor, too, might cringe a little bit when he takes on a rookie who's made a mistake that has interfered with the investigation. Mm-hmm. So make him good. Make sure we want to spend time with them. Give them a little sense of humor, but not silly. And then give them an edge, something that will make them real.
Wonderful. That's fantastic. I want to mention again, the name of the new novel is The Goodbye Man by Jeffrey Deaver. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Shalah, thank you so much now. Take care.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with international best-selling and award-winning author Jeffrey Deaver. You can learn more about his work at jeffreydeaver.com. Jeffrey Deaver mentioned during our interview that when the time comes to finish his research and begin putting words on the page, he likes to write in the dark. This week, try writing in the dark. See if the words come more easily to you this way, as they do for him. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Google Play and all the podcast places, as well as writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, as always, please do talk about it with your friends and rate it in iTunes and like it on Facebook. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.